On a recent bird survey trip to Cuba, I talked with Gary Malkowski, the founder of Caribbean Conservation Trust, about the changes he has seen in the 20 years he has had a U.S. State Department-issued license to lead small groups to explore the natural beauty of Cuba. What is your background that led you to bring birdwatchers to Cuba, where it remains illegal for U.S. citizens to travel without a license?
I have a degree in criminal justice, experience in environmental education, experiential learning, and adventure travel. In my father's career, he worked for the federal government for the legal field, and I guess, had this comfort with navigating federal regulation. One part in terms of getting access as a U.S. citizen to Cuba 20 years ago, and much different environment for U.S. citizens. My start in Cuba was supported with the help of a friend who'd been here doing research looking for the ivory-billed woodpecker.
You started taking people to Cuba about 20 years ago. How have U.S. regulations changed over those years?
At the time, when I first applied for authorization, I needed to write a letter, and it was on a single page, and the questions were, what's your justification for pursuing a license to travel to Cuba? And this was in 1995. 8 years later, there was a great deal more detail and more structure in terms of a burden of proof regarding what our government and the offices, the U.S. Department of Treasury, Office of Foreign Assets Control, that issued or denied license applications. So around 2002, that process became much more specific, much more laborious, much more time-consuming, and that lasted about a year ago when the Obama administration changed policies and expanded the parameters for authorized travel.
So that's changed according to the presidential?
Yeah, I think it's always been a matter of political perspective and interpretation. Like all statutes, all aspects of written law are interpreted in some cases by individual discretion and in this case by a pretty important individual. Hence we have a broader scope of what is legitimate. There still is a need for authorization, and there still are prohibitions against recreational travel to Cuba.
Have there been similar changes in the Cuban government relative to U.S. tourists coming to Cuba?
They're dealing with more of us, but the changes that are significant that I think were part of what was negotiated by both governments over the last couple of years have resulted in, as you've been experienced, but just a higher level of interest and hope and energy. It's a very dynamic time to be in Cuba, either as a visitor or as a citizen. Comparatively, the first few years I came here, I came during what was called the special period. This is what the Cuban government deemed the years following the exodus of the Soviets, who had supported much of the economic foundation of Cuba and a lot of the governmental policies and basically the domestic identity and international identity of the country. They were pretty much a benevolent benefactor. They left suddenly and without any kind of support, and the Cubans were for the first time really in the history of this country truly autonomous. So they endured roughly 400 years of Spanish colonial government and influence, and then a little more than 50 years influence from the United States, and then another 50 or so Soviet Union, and all of a sudden nobody was on the other side of that door. Cuba struggled immensely with meeting very basic needs. I've seen a tremendous change in what the average Cuban has had to live with and define his or her life by. And that change has been most noticeable and most dramatic in the last 2 years.
Are there official government agencies that deal with protecting reserved areas or identifying possible reserve areas?
Yes, there are. They're equivalent to our Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Environmental Protection. There are not any provincial entities comparatively. We have our federal government conservation entities, we have our state entities, we have local Audubons and local independent conservation organizations really do a bulk of the work in the U.S. and internationally. That doesn't really happen in Cuba. It's all something that is the responsibility of the Cuban government. Hopefully that changes with the evolution of relations between the U.S. and Cuba.
What are the key habitats for bird watching on the island?
BirdLife International has designated 28 IBAs, or important bird areas. Habitat in those IBAs varies from coastal habitat to semi-deciduous forests, submontane forests, mountain rainforests, and coastal scrub. 20% of Cuba's land is protected.
That seems like a fairly high percent.
It is, yeah. However, the increase in tourism has impacted some formerly pristine uninhabited habitat, where, for example, you just returned from Cayo Coco, and I understand that you had a hard time finding the Bahama mockingbird, but it's endangered in a very localized part of Cuba, and we used to find the bird relative ease up until about 3 years ago, and we don't find it because they're building three hotels in that, you know, scrub area and beach area. So this is a perfect example of how changes that are occurring in Cuba that bring a lot of benefits have an impact on conservation.
How much is the Cuban government preparing infrastructure to handle the expansion of numbers of people, where they'll stay, and locations of new buildings?
They've been working on this for 20 years. From a conservation perspective, the work has been going relatively slowly. Cuba was immune to that, economic and political isolation, and their own decision to not rely on what is the eyes of the government, a fairly capitalistic enterprise. They've been figuring it out, both politically and pragmatically, and needed a lot of advice and a lot of help. They got that primarily from European and Canadian hotel chains, which they have partnerships with. Now, clearly, the U.S. is, if they're not the most predominant nation in terms of visitors, now they will be. One of the positive consequences of demands that exceed capacity is that the Cuban government has continued to encourage private citizens to become involved with providing services and accommodation to visitors. That wasn't the case when they first started. They did allow private restaurants and private homestays, but the restrictions were greater than they are now.
Does part of that have to do with the change in presidency here?
The current administration has dealt more pragmatically and progressively with the needs and desires of the Cuban population than the previous administration. So the two Castro brothers, Fidel Castro's revolution and government made a lot of positive changes. You know, the average Cuban at the forefront of those policy decisions, but something happened in the 50 or so years that he was in power where there wasn't enough innovation, enough dialogue in terms of how the average Cuban lived his or her day or career or lifetime to really allow for a hopeful future. And going back to my initial years here, I see a completely different attitude. It's an exciting and interesting time to be here.
So is there positive feedback to the central government here that, in fact, this tourism and ecotourism is really having an impact on not just Havana, but throughout the country?
Havana is, like any national capital, the epicenter of this whole change. Where we're most interested in having an impact, localities that are near national parks and designated important birding areas where people are more isolated, they're seeing the great interest, not just from U.S. citizens, but global citizens visiting Cuba, in the more protected and pristine and preserved parts of their country. It's the most biodiverse country in the region, again, because of recent history of political and economic isolation. They've preserved a lot of the land, particularly coastal areas. We're in Havana right now. We're on the 22nd floor of what was built as the Havana Hilton and opened in 1959, just as this major transition was occurring. This is the tallest hotel in the country. It's seen better days, and it was actually never completed. These are examples of how, by circumstance, we've not seen a lot of development here. The fear is that once there's no embargo, once there are absolutely no restrictions for U.S. citizens to visit Cuba and U.S. businesses to invest here, then this is going to change radically, the landscape. I don't know when that'll be. A lot has to happen. This is not a typical environment where they're going to allow foreign governments or private corporations to, nobody can simply come here and buy land or buy building. I think we're years away from that kind of wholesale trade of property and development, but certainly the cat's out of the bag. Again, I think the government here has done a commendable job preserving a large percentage of the land. The message has been made fairly clear that there is a value to conservation. You can both protect land for the purpose of enabling nature to run its course, but also intelligently develop facilities for people to appreciate that natural process. And tourism has become the number one resource in Cuba. This is a beautiful country. I have a lot of hope and faith in the Cuban people. who do understand the value of what they have here and who do also have an understanding of perspective that is not Cuban. So they can be voices that are heard here among the voices that want more hotel space, which is a real need, or want development that might come at the cost of important habitat, like we're seeing in Cayo Coco.
In next week's EcoReport feature, I interview Arturo Kirkconnell, Cuban biologist and co-author of the Field Guides to the Birds of Cuba, about the natural history of his native country. For WFHB, this has been Bob Kissel reporting from Habana, Cuba.